Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says Tehran will not forgo its defensive power, regional presence and nuclear progress in order to protect itself against sanctions. Russian forces encircle four major Ukrainian cities and get closer to the capital Kiev on the 16th day of their offensive there. Also in the headlines, U.S. consumer prices hit a new 40-year high as the world's largest economy continues to be battered by a surge of inflation. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the country should not budge on its regional presence or its nuclear progress vis-a-vis the United States simply to protect itself from sanctions, as this hurts Iran's national power. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said such propositions that Iran needs to reduce its defense power so as not to provoke the enemies are extremely naive and amateurish. He said such ideas have been raised in the past but turned down every time. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Iran would be facing grave threats today if those proposals had been enacted. He said regional presence is what gives Iran strategic depth and greater power. Similarly, the leader said Iran has no reason to give up on its advancements in nuclear technology because that would make the country dependent on others when the need arises in the near future. The leader was addressing members of Iran's Assembly of Experts. Political commentator Fuad Izadi has joined us with his take on the remarks made by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei about the need to boost the country's defense power.
This issue that the leader of the Islamic Republic talked about today is one of his core beliefs, whether there are talks in Vienna or not. I think he genuinely believes that making sure that the country can defend itself on all fronts is a necessity. And giving up Iran's power is delusional. It's not going to happen. The other side, the Western countries, know that Iran is not making a nuclear weapon. And they need to realize that dictating foreign policy goals that they have with regard to Iran is not going to be accepted in Tehran. Iran's foreign policy, Iran's domestic policy is a matter of internal decision. And they have a chance to correct the failed policies of Trump in Vienna, or they can continue the failed policies. What is clear is that Iran is going to make sure that its national interest is going to be protected. Given what's going on in the world as we speak, we realize that if a country cannot defend itself, the difficulties will arise. So that's a good example for Iran and others.
Negotiations to revive the 2015 landmark Iran deal are underway in Austria's capital. Now Iran's foreign minister says a good and durable agreement is within reach if the United States acts realistically and consistently. In a tweet, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said no single party can determine the end result of the negotiations. He said a joint endeavor is needed to accomplish the Vienna talks. Earlier, the top diplomat rejected what he called the U.S. excessive demands, saying they do not have a logical justification. The eighth round of negotiations are now underway in Vienna. Iran says a deal is possible if the West makes necessary decisions. The verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. does not leave the agreement are Iran's key demands. It says the deal will not be possible if everything is not agreed upon. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas says Iran's long history of resistance against U.S. sanctions enables it to withstand Washington's excessive demands during the Vienna talks.
But Iran is still being pretty magnanimous in these negotiations, in spite of seeing the American ship sinking very, very steadily before our very eyes. And with the economic collapse coming, you don't know what else is going to happen in terms of the Western situation around their own economic status. Iran is not going to be affected. Iran has been suffering from economic sanctions for decades. They've gone through the most abysmal and abhorrent sanctions. Now, that's one of the issues that is going to be a real sticking point within the negotiations. And I'm sure this is the one which the Americans are trying somehow to get out of. And that is, they want to lift any sanctions. But, of course, Iran is going to be demanding that not only are they lifted, but there are guarantees, and there is a clear-cut route for the cancellation of those quite abhorrently sanctioned.
Reports coming out of Saudi Arabia suggest an oil refinery has been hit in the capital Riyadh, causing a small fire. Saudi state media says the refinery was targeted with a drone without providing further information. It also said that the fire caused after the attack was controlled and did not result in any casualties. It added that the refinery operations and supplies were not affected as well. We will bring you more details on the story in the coming news bulletins. Now, key battleground developments on day 16 of Russia's multi-pronged offensive in Ukraine. Russian forces are encircling at least four major cities and get closer to the capital, Kiev. In eastern Ukraine, the city of Kharkiv is likely surrounded, though still in the Ukrainian government's hands. The city of Sumy in northeast is already encircled by Russian troops, but thousands of locals have been able to leave through a humanitarian corridor. In the north, the capital Kiev remains under heavy bombardment, with a column of Russian armored vehicles massing outside the city. However, reports suggest the column is suffering losses. In the south, Russia has besieged the strategic city of Mariupol and attempts to evacuate an estimated 200,000 civilians from the city. Russian forces last week took the southern city of Kherson, and there is heavy fighting for control of the city of Mykolaiv. Our correspondent Robert Carter joined us earlier to talk about the influx of Ukrainian refugees that have been fleeing to Poland. He says the country has received the largest share of refugees and will be facing a huge battle to shelter these people.
Well over a million people are now inside, are inside Poland right now. So it's a huge uphill battle that Poland is facing to try and cater for all of these new guests. In fact, I have a statistic which suggests, it was published by the Wall Street Journal today, that up to two Ukrainian refugees are entering Poland every 3 seconds right now. So that's just how serious the situation is. Obviously, Poland is a country which traditionally doesn't like to take in refugees, as we've seen from their handling of African or Middle Eastern refugees in past crises. They prefer to keep them out. But on this occasion, they've opened their doors and they're now trying to handle this influx of mass people, this mass movement that has occurred. So obviously, the situation here, Poland is facing its own battle with the refugee situation. But the situation inside Ukraine is intensifying, and obviously reports are coming in thick and fast of continued fighting and bomb attacks and things like that. And obviously the capital, Kiev, is a hot spot for that violence. And the more the violence inside Ukraine escalates, more refugees from other parts of the country start to look to leave. And of course, the majority of them are heading to Poland.
The United States says it is in discussions with its allies about the effectiveness of anti-Russian sanctions. Vice President Kamala Harris says Moscow must face, quote, severe and swift consequences over its Ukraine offensive. She has also called for investigations into Russia's conduct in the war.
We are in ongoing discussions with Poland and our allies about the effectiveness of sanctions thus far and going forward. This is a moment that requires severe and swift consequence for Russia's aggression against Ukraine. Absolutely, there should be an investigation, and we should all be watching. And I have no question the eyes of the world are on this war and what Russia has done in terms of this aggression and these atrocities. I have no doubt. The United States' commitment to Article 5 is ironclad. The United States is prepared to defend every inch of NATO territory. The United States takes seriously that an attack against one is an attack against all. We are pleased to have announced this week that we have directed two Patriot missile defense systems to Poland, and today I can announce that we have delivered those Patriot systems to Poland.
Meanwhile, the Russian president slams as illegitimate sanctions imposed by Western countries on his country over its military operation in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin is warning of inevitable negative consequences for world markets if the West, quote, creates problems for Russia. He says global food prices will rise further should economic pressure be intensified on Russia, which is a major global fertilizer producer. Putin's remarks come 2 days after the U.S. president announced a ban on Russian oil, natural gas, and coal imports. Washington and its Western allies, including the European Union, have also taken a series of other punitive measures over its Ukraine offensive. A number of major Russian banks have been blacklisted. The sanctions, coupled with the conflict, are already wreaking havoc on the global markets and economy. In the U.S., consumer prices hit a new 40-year high amid rising inflation in the world's largest economy. The Labor Department says the consumer price index was at nearly 8% in February compared to the same month last year. That's the biggest jump since January 1982. The rise comes as gasoline, food, and housing prices have skyrocketed. The Federal Reserve is set to increase interest rates to deal with the rising inflation. It is expected that the fallout from Russia's military action in Ukraine will exacerbate the crisis. Financial experts warn of another shock as a result of the West's anti-Moscow sanctions. Russia is a major producer of oil and natural gas, as well as some food commodities. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un orders officials to expand a site for launching intercontinental ballistic missiles and turn it into, quote, an ultra-modern advanced base. Kim issued the order during a visit to the Suhai satellite launching ground. He said the site, which has been used for various rockets tests in the past, should be expanded to launch multi-purpose satellites. The North Korean leader added the base should serve as ground to make the country a space power. Kim also revealed that Pyongyang has plans to launch a number of reconnaissance satellites in the coming years to provide real-time information on military activities of the United States. Meanwhile, South Korea and the U.S. jointly announced that the North used a new ICBM in its recent two weapons tests. Now, March 11 marks the 10th anniversary of the Kandahar massacre, on which a U.S. Army sergeant murdered 16 Afghan civilians and wounded six others, including children, in the eastern Afghanistan. 10 years on, Afghanistan's public opinion is still seeking justice for the massacre. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gelani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a two rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, noise raids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The speed of Western retaliation over Russia's invasion of Ukraine has raised eyebrows among Yemenis who have endured a relentless bombing campaign and deadly air, land, and sea blockade for 2,520 consecutive days, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article titled "Tears for Ukraine, Sanctions for Russia, Yawns for Yemen, Arms for Saudis, The West, Grotesque Double Standard." Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. "We are brutally bombed every day, so why doesn't the Western world care like it does about Ukraine? Is it because we don't have blonde hair and blue eyes like Ukrainians?" Ahmad Tamri, a Yemeni father of four, asked with furrowed brows about the outpouring of international support and media coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the lack of such a reaction to the war in Yemen. Over the weekend, a member of Tamri's family was killed and nine relatives injured when their family home was targeted in a Saudi-led coalition airstrike in the remote Al-Sakhf area in Hejeh Governorate. Tamri claims that Al-Sakhf has been subjected to a brutal Saudi bombing campaign for the past 7 years, more so, he says, than all of Ukraine has endured since it was invaded by Russia. Despite the horrific bombing campaign against Yemeni civilians, Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and war crimes have garnered nowhere near the level of coverage and sympathy that the mainstream Western media has rightfully given to Ukraine. They shed tears for the Ukrainians and ignore our tragedies. What hypocrisy and racism, Tamri told Min Press News. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine continues, an outpouring of support for Ukrainians continues to be seen across the Western world. Severe sanctions against Russia have been imposed by the United States, Europe, Australia, and the West in general, amid a flurry of emergency talks at the UN Security Council. The speed of Western retaliation, which includes banning Russia from the SWIFT, that is, Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications International Banking Network, and calls to treat Russians as international pariah in sports, culture, and even science, has raised eyebrows among Yemenis who have endured a relentless bombing campaign and deadly air, land, and sea blockade for 2,550 consecutive days. When Russian forces began their wide-ranging assault on Ukraine, the Saudi-led coalition, supported by the U.S. regime, has launched more airstrikes in Yemen than Russia has in Ukraine. In Hejeh, a province surrounded by heavy Saudi artillery, Saudi-led coalition warplanes launched more than 150 airstrikes on the cities of Harath, Hiran, Up, and Mustab, killing scores of civilians, including a father of six killed over the weekend by a Saudi drone that targeted his car as it traveled between Shafar and Khamis al-Wahat market. Since Russia's incursion into Ukraine began, dozens of civilians, including a number of African migrants, have been killed and hundreds wounded by Saudi artillery and airstrikes in Yemen's heavily populated Sa'dah province, declared a military area by Saudi Arabia at the start of its military campaign in March 2015. As news cameras and solidarity protests gave much-needed sympathy to Ukrainian civilians in Sana'a, Yemen, which has effectively been turned into a large prison for the city's more than 4 million residents and refugees, thanks to a crippling Saudi blockade, warplanes bombed a number of densely populated areas, including the airport. An additional 160 airstrikes were launched on the provinces of Ma'rib, Al-Jaf, Al-Bayda, Taiz, Najran, and Hodeidah, the main entry point for commercial goods and aid into a country facing the worst man-made famine in the 21st century. In fact, it seems as though the Saudi regime is taking advantage of a distracted media in order to escalate attacks on a number of sensitive targets along the Yemen-Saudi border and strengthen its hold over the Al-Mahra governorate. The UAE, the other major Western-backed oil monarchy occupying Yemen, is likewise making hay, accelerating its project to change the demographics on the prized Socotra Island by displacing locals in favor of settlers more aligned with UAE policies. as countries that have spent the past decades building literal and figurative walls to keep out desperate brown and black refugees fleeing violence and foreign invasion in their own lands open their arms, homes, and hearts to fleeing Ukrainian refugees. Saudi Arabia unleashed the force of Yemeni mercenaries upon their homeland with a promise of a Saudi green card and safety for their families if they turn on their fellow countrymen. Ironically named the Happy Yemen Forces, the unit was finalized in late 2021 according to leaked military documents, with a mandate to secure Saudi Arabia's border with Yemen and ensure Saudi security in exchange for a green card and access to the Saudi social services that come with it. In terms of their sheer cost of human life, the tragedy in Yemen has been much more deadly than that in Ukraine, where 325 Ukrainians, including 14 children, have tragically lost their lives, according to Ukrainian officials. Granted, the war in Yemen has raged on unabated for more than 6 years, but comparatively, the numbers are astonishing. Since 2015, the death toll has reached an estimated 400,000 people, including 3,900 children. Those deaths have included attacks on civilians so egregious that they did garner fleeing media attention, but inevitably no sanctions, little international condemnation, not even a cessation in the military aid and support to the perpetrators. Bombed out schools, funerals, wedding halls, refugee camps, even a school bus full of children targeted by the most advanced U.S. weaponry on offer have not been sufficient to elicit the reaction that Ukraine has garnered in less than 1 week. Since 2015, Saudi-led coalition warplanes have pounded Yemen with over 266,000 airstrikes, according to the Yemeni Army Operations Room, which records airstrikes against civilian and military targets. 70% of those strikes have hit civilian targets. The rising smoke, rubble, and flames now seen in Ukraine have been the status quo in Yemen for years, with Western media often deeming the images that appear on local Yemeni television stations of parents pulling pieces of their children out from the rubble of their homes or schools too graphic to display.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here is a wonderful piece of advice from the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, also known as Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him. God says, O son of Adam, satisfy yourself with that which I have given to you, and you will be the most abstinent of people. O son of Adam, carry out the duties that I have made incumbent upon you, and you will be the best worshipper of people. O son of Adam, avoid acting matters that I have deemed forbidden, and you will be the most pious of people.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee, and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice-regent, imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام الرفق نصف العيش.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, moderation is worth half of one's livelihood.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find, dear friends, in the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, that interestingly, this divinely appointed imam has spoken about with his companions in certain conversations how an individual should not refuse the granting of a need of his believing brother or sister. Now, of course, in certain programs, we have talked about the importance of helping to give sanctuary to a believer and helping and striving to grant the needs of a believer. And of course, if we look at this on a very societal level, a socio-political level, if you will, when people begin to help one another and begin to grant the needs of one another, of course, when they have the means to, then the society will begin to progress. The society will begin to move forwards towards that utopian and perfect society that Allah, the Almighty, the Just, has ordained for humanity. And so in this conversation, Imam Al-Kadhim says, when he is talking about those who do not refuse to grant the need of their believing brother, meaning those who grant the need of their believing brother, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam says in this conversation, surely Allah has on the earth servants who strive to grant the needs of men. They are safe on the day of resurrection. And whoever delights a believer, Allah will delight their heart on the day of resurrection. So, dear brothers, yes, in this world we reach a utopian society by means of helping our brothers and sisters. But on the other hand, here Imam Al-Kadhim tells us that even in the afterlife, in the hereafter, we don't want to call it afterlife because it is the actual life. So the hereafter, they will be safe on the day of resurrection. And if they delight a believer, Allah will delight their heart on the day of resurrection, a day which is very frightening for every single one of us. May Allah protect us. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
And imagine when the Imam alayhi salam would say, حاسبوا أنفسكم قبل أن تحاسبوا وزنوها قبل أن توزنوا. Ensure that you hold yourself accountable before the day of judgment. If an individual is so engrossed in this form of muhasaba and self-accountability, the way our ulama, such as Allama Tabatabai Ridwanullahi Ta'ala alayhi, one of his students says in his final moments, before he died, before he passed away, he said to him, Allama, tell me something that will help me in my life. The narrations from this particular student says that he said, Alaykum bil muraqaba, alaykum bil muhasaba. He was a man who understood the importance of self-accountability and holding ourselves to measure when it comes to our actions, in order for us to think twice or three times the next time we are presented with a temptation or a situation whereby we are drawn into Shaitan's web of deception. And the Imam alayhi salam would also want to ensure that we understand the beauty of what the religion says about the need to focus on the sincerity of our actions, and the fact that the quality of the a'mal is what is measured in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not necessarily the quantity.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق
10 minutes.
The Russian attack on Ukraine. The power keg finally exploded on the 24th of February, not after months, but years of tension between NATO and Moscow, turning the Cold War between Russia and the West hot again. The finger of blame immediately fell on the Russian president. This was always about naked aggression, about Putin's desire for empire by any means necessary. The US president rushed to condemn the attack on the very same day. Biden, however, didn't bother to draw attention to NATO's arrogant policy towards Russia over the past quarter century. As the most powerful military alliance in history, NATO has long been creeping towards Russia without heeding Moscow's warnings. As they say, the first casualty when war comes is truth. On February 9, 1990, and in the process of German unification, then US Secretary of State James Baker's famously assured Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO expansion would not be one inch eastward. And it was just part of a cascade of assurances about Soviet security made by Western leaders to Gorbachev and other Soviet officials. But in practice, the West backtracked on its promise. The first move was initiated under Bill Clinton in 1993, when his administration proposed inviting Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary to become NATO members, which the US Senate finally approved in 1998. The first wave of membership expansion was met with a strong reaction by the Russians. In her memoir, Madeleine Albright, Clinton's Secretary of State, writes, Russian President Boris Yeltsin and his countrymen were strongly opposed to enlargement, seeing it as a strategy for exploiting their vulnerability and moving Europe's dividing line to the east, leaving them isolated. In spite of Moscow's objection, US and NATO leaders proceeded with new rounds of expansion, taxing the patience of the Russians. In 2004, three former Soviet republics, namely Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, were brought into NATO. Meanwhile, American rockets were placed in Poland and Romania, and Ukraine was armed with Western weaponry. In March 2007, Vladimir Putin gave his last friendly warning at the annual Munich Security Conference. He said, NATO has put its frontline forces on our borders. Its expansion represents a serious provocation that reduces the level of mutual trust. And we have the right to ask, against whom is this expansion intended? And what happened to the assurances our Western partners made after the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact? Putin's warnings went practically unheard. Instead, the US tried to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, recklessly ignoring what the Russians regarded as their own vital national interests. In retrospect, the Obama administration's interference in Ukraine's internal political affairs in 2013 and 2014 to help demonstrators overthrow Ukraine's elected pro-Russia president was the last straw. In recent months, the Kremlin demanded that NATO provide assurances that the organization would reduce the scope of its military presence in Eastern Europe and would never offer membership to Ukraine. The Biden administration's response was, however, disappointing. Now Washington's attempt to make Ukraine a NATO pawn has cost the Ukrainian people dearly. The current escalation has yet another side to reveal: Western hypocrisy and double standards. The attack on Ukraine has drawn strong condemnation by almost all Western countries and has triggered immediate sanctions by the United States and other countries targeting Russian banks, oil refineries and military exports. The speed of such an international response has raised eyebrows at the lack of such a reaction to other conflicts across the world. At the same time, the mainstream media have been accused of using their outlets to not only praise Ukraine's resistance to Russian troops, but also to underline their shock at how such a conflict could happen to a civilized nation. What CBS News senior correspondent in Kiev, Charlie DeAgata, said when describing the event is just a case in point.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
As just another example, the British writer Daniel Hannan wrote in The Telegraph, "They seem so like us. That is what makes it shocking. War is no longer something visited upon impoverished and remote populations. It can happen to anyone."
Vladimir Putin is prepared to use barbaric and indiscriminate tactics against innocent civilians, to bomb tower blocks, to send missiles into tower blocks, to kill children, as we're seeing in increasing numbers.
Such statements in the mainstream media have contributed to the further dehumanization of non-white, non-European people suffering from conflicts mostly caused by NATO forces, troops with blue eyes and blonde hair. Mostly caused by NATO forces, troops with blue eyes and blonde hair. From this particular point of view, Libyan, Afghan, Iraqi and Syrian lives don't matter, for they are looked upon as uncivilized. A desperate Syrian refugee recently told Reuters, "We are wondering, why were Ukrainians welcome in all countries while we Syrian refugees are still in tents and remain under the snow, facing death, and no one is looking to us?" Even European politicians have expressed support for open borders towards Ukrainian refugees, referring to them as intellectuals and European, in a stark contrast with the rhetoric they have been using for migrants and refugees from Africa, the Middle East and Central Asia. In the words of Jean-Louis Brulange, a member of the French National Assembly, the Ukrainian refugees will be an immigration of great quality intellectuals, those whom we will be able to take advantage of. In fact, the sorrow and despair the West is feeling for Ukraine has not been identical to the sorrow and despair it feels for Yemen, Palestine and Syria, or other war-torn nations in the region. If war is bad, it is bad for all humanity. This selective empathy and sympathy means the West has still a long way to go to really believe in what it has long been preaching the world about: human lives matter, no matter where they belong to.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Small arms and light weapons empower bad actors and reduce human freedom around the world. says Jordan Cohen, writer, in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. Must Monitor Arms Sales." Stay tuned for more. New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, recently published an op-ed announcing legislation that would make Colombia a major non-NATO ally. Colombia is a major recipient of U.S. weapons sales, receiving over $1 billion in arms since 2012. Unfortunately, these weapons have been used to support a government that attacks human rights protesters, supports human trafficking, and commits sexual violence. The problems in Colombia are not specific to that country, but reveal a broader failure to monitor the final recipients of U.S. weapons. The U.S. must fix this problem before allowing Colombia or any other major American weapons recipient to become MNNA. Previously, the U.S. State Department monitored the distribution of U.S. weapons exports. In March 2020, former President Donald Trump shifted that responsibility to the Commerce Department. Since then, Washington has transferred over 4,000 firearms to Central America's Northern Triangle and approved more than 110,000 in future sales. This end-use monitoring regime is problematic, according to a recent report by the Government Accountability Office. The GAO notes that the Commerce Department only conducted two end-use checks in 2021. In the six previous years, by contrast, end-use checks led to seizure of 130 firearms, 3,500 firearm components, and 217,000 rounds of ammunition. Failing to conduct end-use checks means that many of the 4,000 recently transferred firearms likely will end up in the wrong hands. Failing to oversee these transactions is both negligent and renders the U.S. complicit in homicide. Central America's Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador contains 47 of the 50 cities with the most murders in the world. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms studied the origin of recovered firearms in Mexico and the Northern Triangle in 2019 and found that the U.S. manufactured 43.7% of the recovered firearms in El Salvador, 34.8% in Guatemala, and 42.8% in Honduras. The U.S. failure to perform end-use checks is a recipe for human rights tragedies. It is also a security risk with economic downsides for the U.S. The Cato Institute's 2021 Arms Sales Risk Index, for example, found that small arms and light weapon sales empower authoritarian rulers, fund criminal organizations, and amplify existing violence and conflict. It is effectively impossible for an arms recipient to disperse a large weapon systems like an F-35, which would be obvious and easy for Washington to prevent. But dispersing a handgun, particularly when the U.S. is not monitoring its final recipient, is much easier. The United States is thus indirectly aiding the same criminal gangs and cartels that the United States targets in international drug trafficking operations. In El Salvador, soldiers sell American-made grenades and other light weapons to the Milenio cartel, whom the U.S. authorities then chase. Similar stories occur in Guatemala and Honduras. In Mexico, an average of 500 guns are illegally smuggled every day and eventually end up in the hands of gang and cartel members throughout South and Central America. Because the Commerce Department fails to closely track the end users of weapons, U.S. weapons end up destabilizing a region and threatening global human rights, all at the American taxpayers' expense. Corporate interests are eager to maintain this ineffective regime, but lawmakers should put human rights at the forefront of U.S. arms sales policy. There is another fiscal cost to the lack of arms sales oversight. The U.S. military is inevitably used to combat downstream problems flowing from unmonitored arms sales. Recipient countries ask for U.S. aid to address resulting security concerns. Indeed, the U.S. spent over $38 million between 2015 to 2019 disrupting firearm trafficking in Central America. As the late P.J. O'Rourke said, freedom is not empowerment. Anybody can grab a gun and be empowered. Small arms and light weapons empower bad actors and reduce human freedom around the world. The cost to the Americans from these arms sales should make Congress think twice before touting their economic benefits.
Iraqis felt betrayed by the BBC. Smears, lies, and Islamophobia. Just a few of the criticisms hurled at the BBC following the release of a controversial documentary. Released in 2019, the 54-minute programme seeks to expose what it claims are Shia clerics acting as pimps and sexual exploitation of vulnerable Iraqi widows under the gaze of Shia Islam's religious authorities. However, after the film's release, Iraqis responded negatively, furiously condemning the documentary and even petitioning for its removal.
You can't attack the doctrine because of the abuse of ignorant people or those who are corrupt.
Those who look at this documentary will have the fuel and will have the somehow justification for themselves to incite others to attack Shias.
There are authorized people you can ask, but you come to dirty humans and ask them instead.
So I decided to travel to Iraq, meet those who spoke with the BBC, and investigate why so many Iraqis felt betrayed rather than saved by the BBC. The majority of the filming for Iraq's secret sex trade took place here in Qardamiyye. Located in Iraq's capital city, Baghdad, Qardamiyye is considered one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. The main mosque, which contains the resting place of two of Shia Islam's holy imams, is featured throughout the program.
Now, these holy sites for Shia Muslims are supervised by the Ataba religious authorities. However, the program suggested that the Ataba and these holy sites were somehow linked or maybe even responsible for the criminal acts that they recorded on film.
The BBC's investigation begins with an attempt at explaining muta, a form of temporary marriage permitted during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. Using undercover filming, the BBC then exposes what it claims were clerics acting as pimps and using muta to run a sex racket. But scholars I spoke to on the subject explained it very differently.
What can you tell me about muta marriage?
Temporary marriage was known at the time of the Prophet ﷺ.